Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged, not just blessed, but privileged each week to have a chance to visit with a man of uncommon intelligence who brings it to bear, well, in so many different ways and on so many different platforms that we're honored to be among them here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Gordon Chang. He's one of our country's preeminent experts on China and much in demand at the moment as we're all trying to figure out what on earth is China up to and what are the implications for us. He's the author of The Coming Collapse of China, among other books. You can follow his work at Gatestone Institute and Newsweek, among other outlets, and of course at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's great to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
You've been writing lately about a couple of things that I wanted to cover with you quickly, Gordon. One that is of great import, not just for the people and government of China, but perhaps for the entire world, namely food shortages that are taking place in China at the moment. You had a fascinating piece in Newsweek in which you described as the new currency of China, the potato. Talk a little bit about what's going on there, and again, its implications for all of us.
Well, the city of Xi'an of 13 million is under a total lockdown, and people have not been able to go out of their homes for food since December 27th. And so many people are going hungry. And what we are seeing is the resumption of barter trade, where people who provide services or whatever, as in this case, tutors, have basically said, we don't want to be paid in money, which can be done through electronic platforms. They want potatoes and they want rice. And other people have also been demanding potatoes in payment for services or goods or whatever. And there's a lot of trading. People are trading some very expensive electronic items for little amounts of food. The story here is not just one of one city under lockdown, but it's over several years, China's food shortages are worsening. And they've become a matter of public concern. Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, had a clean your plate campaign of a couple of years ago, ordering cadres to order only a certain number of dishes at meals. And this is a real indication that China really understands that it's heading into food crisis. Each year, it is projected that China will be less foods self-sufficient. And this is creating all sorts of effects on China's external behavior, including its buying of food companies and farmland around the world, including the U.S.
Gordon, this is something with which the Chinese have a long and terrible history, particularly under the Chinese Communist Party. And when you say people are hungry, there are actually reports that people are starving in Xi'an. There's an expression you introduced me to that is not an uncommon greeting in China, born of this hard experience. I think you said it's something like, have you eaten lately? And what this suggests is that there's a potential for problem to be threatening to the regime itself if it isn't brought under control. Which brings me to a couple of things that the Chinese are reportedly doing, namely hoarding food purchased from around the world, greatly reducing the supplies that might be available to other nations, buying up agricultural land around the world, including here in the United States, and otherwise possibly putting great stress on the supply of food that might be available to others should there be shortages globally, not just in China. Your thoughts on all of that?
China's been ramping up its grain purchases from around the world, and it is hoarding, and that is starting to cause concern elsewhere. This is important because China just can't feed itself, even in the best of times. And we are seeing in China right now, for instance, last year and the year before, flooding, which really undercut their ability to produce food. So China's solution is just to buy whatever it can. So it's buying farmland in Africa and in the U.S. Midwest, also in Texas. It bought Smithfield Foods. So this has really been a concerted campaign for the last 3 or 4 years. And it is worrying because other countries are starting to worry that they won't have enough ability. They won't have the ability and the sources to buy food for themselves. So this is an international issue. China's problems are becoming the problems of the world.
As has been the case with COVID, among other things. And Gordon, this point about buying up productive farmland, it was brought home to me over the weekend, as a matter of fact, by an expatriate from South Africa who said an entire province of that country, including much of its sort of breadbasket agricultural productive land, has been essentially surrendered to China for 99 years as part of a settlement of debt associated with the Belt and Road Initiative in South Africa. And this is not the only place where this sort of foreclosing is taking place, but this one really has, again, profound implications for the agricultural productivity of an important country, not just in Southern Africa, but throughout that region. Let me turn, if I could, Gordon, to another piece of that. I mentioned COVID-19. We are launching today a campaign aimed at trying to prevent our athletes from being exposed perhaps to a new and even more dangerous strain of COVID, which may account for the kinds of draconian steps that you've just described, of the Chinese locking down a city like Xi'an of 13 million people. We're suggesting that the genocide games should not be attended by American athletes under these circumstances, and have urged people to go to genocidegames.com and sign a letter to the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee to urge them, in turn, to encourage our athletes not to go. How serious a problem do you think what's happening in China is at the moment in terms of health crises? There's even talk about hemorrhagic fever being a problem, as well as whatever's developing on their COVID front.
Yes, there are reports of hemorrhagic fever in Xi'an. With regard to COVID, there's an outbreak in Tianjin, which is a provincial-level city which abuts Beijing, and they're locking that down as well. And this means that the virus is getting closer and closer to the location of the games. Also, China has reported its first community transmission of the Omicron variant. So there are more and more reports that Beijing is losing control of the disease. This is important because the International Olympic Committee postponed the Tokyo Games, the Summer Games in 2020, for 1 year because of coronavirus concerns. And it seems to me that if nothing else, they should be postponing the Beijing Winter Olympics also because of disease concerns. Now, there are, of course, a lot of other reasons for that, including the fact that China is committing genocide, crimes against humanity, and other atrocities. And also, we shouldn't be fueling a hostile state with the money and the legitimization that an Olympics confers. But putting those aside for a moment, which the IOC has done, this is just an issue of the safety of the athletes. And so, therefore, the IOC should, at very minimum, just say, let's wait for the end of the disease before the Winter Olympics begin.
You know, I've done a commentary today, Gordon, about the prospect that the Olympic Games might prove to be a super spreader event using these athletes, as seemingly was done in 2019, October of 2019, specifically with respect to the military games that were held in Wuhan, China, and may have been one of the first places where the proliferation of this what now became a pandemic worldwide took place. Let me turn quickly to two of your other topics, Gordon, before we run out of time. Kazakhstan, what is going on there at the moment? And what are the Russians and Chinese doing that suggests it's considered to be a problem for both of those authoritarian or totalitarian regimes as well?
Well, Russia has sent about 3,000 troops, and they're under the color of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, CSTO. Putin has claimed that that has quelled the protests, as has the Kazakh government. The death toll officially is 160 people and about 5,000 in detention. We really don't know at this particular time whether those claims are correct. We know that both China and Russia are concerned by what they call color revolutions. They worry about that spreading through the region, and so they have taken a very harsh position. And I think that, you know, we're going to find out. But this is one of those things where there was discontent across Kazakh society. And that was because of the economic failure there, the hardship. These protests were triggered because of a removal of the price caps on liquefied natural gas, which is used to power cars. Prices doubled, and so people took to the streets. Those problems haven't gone away, Russian troops or no Russian troops. So this is a story which will continue for quite some time. It's like, I think, Hong Kong, which is an insurgency. Security forces can quell it for a moment, but they have to continue to apply pressure because people are angry and they will continue to show their discontent. And we will see flare-ups in Hong Kong, as I'm sure we'll see flare-ups in Kazakhstan.
Fascinating. I haven't heard much about insurgencies in Hong Kong since the national security law was imposed upon the place by the Chinese Communist Party, and it will be fascinating to watch whether that plays out, Gordon. Let me turn, though, finally to one other topic that you've been writing about lately, and that is this peculiar posture of the Biden administration with respect to the imperative need to collaborate with the Chinese Communist Party on climate change. This is no longer just the idée fixe, if you will, of John Kerry. We're hearing the Defense Department's press spokesman saying that the Chinese military threat is equally important to the cooperation between the United States and the Chinese government on climate change, which seems unbelievable to me. We also have Kurt Campbell, longtime denizen of Democratic administrations now at the National Security Council, insisting that it's the most climate change is in cooperation with China about it is the most important element of the decade. What are we to make of all of this? Gordon can comment on the scientific merits if you choose to, but I'm mostly interested in what you think about how the Chinese are likely to exploit this fixation to our great detriment and their benefit.
President Biden believes that climate change, not China, is the number one national security threat. As he has said on a number of occasions, including his speech when he arrived in Europe. This is the view that is shared throughout the administration, and that's the reason why Kurt Campbell, who is the National Security Council Asia czar, recently said that cooperation with China is the paramount challenge of this decade. Well, whatever one thinks of climate change, and I do worry about it, but nonetheless, climate change did not kill 838,000 Americans, which is the toll as reported by the Johns Hopkins Resource Center as of today. So I think that there's a fundamental misconception of what's occurring. And even if one puts climate change at the top of the list of threats, coming to agreement with China is the least likely way that we're going to do anything about climate, because as we've seen, China does not honor its agreements. The one thing that we can do about climate, which the Biden administration doesn't talk about, and which would have the greatest impact in reducing carbon emissions, would be to relocate manufacturing back to this side of the Pacific, either in the United States itself or in Central America for low-cost manufacturing. And the reason is that, as people have reported, 15 of the world's largest container ships pour as much carbon into the air as all the world's car. So if we really want to do something about climate, let's bring it back here. By the way, doing this, whether we do it for climate or not, will have other incidental impacts. One of them is we'll stop feeding a hostile Chinese regime. Also, we will go a long way to reducing our supply chain vulnerabilities because our supply chains stretch halfway across the world. And also, this would end the caravans pressing our southern border because people from Central America wouldn't be leaving their societies if they had jobs at home. And we can certainly get factories to go back to Central America if we were to change CAFTA, our free trade agreement with the region.
It will require them to avoid nationalizing our industries, though. I think it's fair to say we're seeing more and more the rise of, well, communists in the region, in part thanks to the Chinese efforts to encourage that kind of transformation, fundamental transformation of our hemisphere. Gordon, so much more to talk with you about this. I think your point particularly about the extent to which the Chinese cannot be relied upon to be of help to us on climate change is one of the things that has to be kind of front and center in any such notions that we can set aside the threat they pose to us. We can ignore the murder that they've perpetrated just with the COVID business, let alone what they have in mind for us if they have their way. This is folly in the extreme, and I appreciate your clarity on that point among others. Gordon, thanks for your time today, as well as for all of the great work that you do. It's vital that people follow you at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, and your writings and appearances, including, of course, those here, which we look forward to having another one of next week. In the meantime, thank you, my friend. God bless you. Keep up the great work. We'll talk with Bill Walton about some financial developments in China and what they might mean for you and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and as is our privilege each week, we are featuring our guest next, Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific television podcast. He is also the former chairman of Allied Capital Corporation, a major Wall Street player, knows his way around the financial sector. He has been a leader of the conservative movement now in recent years as the past president at this point of the Council for National Policy, which I'm proud to be a member. He is also just a fabulous guest here, and we're always delighted to welcome him back. Bill, it's good to have you, sir.
Frank, great to be here.
I want to talk with you about several issues involving China, Bill, because you're following that story closely now, both with your television program and your other good works. China has increasingly been buffeted in international capital markets with the seeming bloom coming off the rose, shall we say, of those investments in China that had been, tractor beams is the way I think of it for a lot of Wall Street mavens like yourself. What is going on and why with respect to these Chinese financial instruments, stocks and bonds of companies controlled by the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, there's been a fascinating divergence this year. If you look at Chinese companies and the ones that are traded internationally, New York Stock Exchange, et cetera, versus the Chinese companies that are traded domestically, the companies trading offshore have plummeted, fallen almost over 42% in the last year to 2021, while Chinese companies listed domestically have risen by about 22%, which more or less tracks what the S&P 500 did in 2021. And what's happening with the offshore companies is that they're getting clobbered on two sides. One, they're getting clobbered by Xi. Most of the companies are the tech companies, the sexier companies that would be appealing to international investors. And Xi has cracked down on them, both in terms of the governance and what they can do and where they can be listed.
That would be, of course, Xi Jinping, the dictator of China you're speaking of.
Gosh, I thought everybody. Yes.
I think President in this Xi, audience, that's President the case. Life. But just to be, care, just to be careful.
I think most of us wouldn't. Anyway, yeah, Xi is the guy. So his crackdown is getting very heavy-handed. And there are a couple things. One is that the government interventions make investors worry a lot about the unpredictability of how the business models can change. The tutoring companies last year, Xi decided that they didn't think they should be for profit, and he essentially just shut them down. And if you had shares in it, you saw them go to zero. So on the one hand, you've got what Xi is doing, and then the other hand, I think investors are waking up, and a lot of the work we've done here to put on notice that if you're investing in a Chinese company that's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, they probably have not been audited properly. And we now have rules in place, which is going to force all of them to comply with U.S. audit standards within the next 3 years. And in China, the Chinese Communist Party does not want to see that happen. So they're withdrawing from the U.S. capital or international capital markets. There's the other thing is going on. The Chinese companies listed in China are pretty much the construction companies, the boring cement companies, the food companies, things like that, which don't have much sex appeal. Nevertheless, they went up 20-25% last year. So it's something that we need to watch.
So you're saying that because the Chinese tech companies are not so prominent in the Chinese market and the boring companies are simply beavering away, that Chinese investors, who presumably are basically picking up the slack for the international investing community, are doing so without the same concerns about the Chinese government's unpredictable manipulation or other predations with respect to these more high-flying companies. Have I got that right?
I think that's right. The thing we need to keep in mind about China is they have 400, 450 million middle-class families or investors, and they've been primarily focused on the real estate market, the property market, and or bank accounts in China, and they've had no place else to go. And one of the reasons the Chinese Communist Party wants to bring the U.S. securities firm into China is to modernize their capital markets and give investors someplace else to go. And that's beginning to have some effect. And so the Chinese, if you're Chinese, you're investing in a Chinese company, you're investing something cement company, a food company, something like that, versus a high-flying tech company, which you may not understand as well. So there's some of that going on as well. But it's, China overall is trying to disengage from the international capital markets, where they've been heavily dependent on it for the last couple of decades. And this is a piece of engineering that Xi is endeavoring to do. And he's in uncharted water. I mean, how you can, Didi, which he demanded, the ride-sharing company, where he demanded that they delist from the New York Stock Exchange, seen its value fall by 40-50%, and it's still falling. And so even if you're a Chinese investor, you look at Didi and you see that it's subject to all of the security issues that Xi's raising, and you say, I'm not going to put money there.
But you touched on something, Bill, that underscores a concern we've had for some time on our Committee on the Present Danger, China, for example, of which you are a member, namely that our masters of the universe, your colleagues on Wall Street, are determined to enable the Chinese Communist Party in its various ambitions, and whether it's putting American investors' funds at risk in China, as they have been doing now for decades, or whether it's this new prospect that they're going to try to help the Chinese Communist Party overhaul their own capital markets and create a mechanism for funding their ambitions, as I say, domestically. It's not in the interest of the United States, either of those, it seems to me. And we have guys like Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, the largest investment company in the world, all in on these agendas. And he got a little bit of, press about what he's up to in terms of his own global ambitions. Talk a little bit about what they are and whether they should be of concern to us.
Well, Larry Fink runs BlackRock. BlackRock manages almost $10 trillion of pension fund money, endowments, individuals, companies, and put the $10 trillion in context. That's about 10% of the world's gross domestic product in 2020. So it is significant, and because of the shareholdings that they have, BlackRock and the other two big money managers, they're the largest shareholders in more than 80% of the companies traded on the S&P 500, and so they have real clout. And Larry, really, along with the other people, other CEOs of the investment managers, who are big proponents of the climate change agenda and ESG investing, which we've talked about. But there's beginning to be a lot of pushback because there's not a lot of evidence that ESG investing or climate change investing is really promoting a high returns in the portfolio. And then there's also just the arrogance factor. Sam Zell, who's a very colorful guy, real estate developer from Chicago, a billionaire himself, said, he said on CNBC, "I didn't know that Larry Fink had been made God." And Larry presides over all this. And, you know, of course, Larry lives well. He's got a huge horse farm up in Westchester County, but I think he sees himself living in the United States, but he sees his platform as global, and he's probably more at home than there in Davos than anywhere else.
Citizen of the world, as they call it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have way too many of those.
We do, and unfortunately, as you say, Bill, they're using their clout to try to affect the global reset that they've put.
But here's a question. Here's something we I do want to get. There's subject matter expertise. There's circles of competence. And Larry Fink got his start at First Boston. He ran a desk to put together mortgages and loans and sold off pieces of the business. I've actually been in that business. It's a pretty good business. It's arcane. But your ability to package bonds together and sell them off, I don't think gives you any special insights into climate change or, being able to dictate, the social agenda of companies. And there they're seeing a lot of pushback. I think most investors or most Americans, he's not alone among the woke CEOs. There are many of them. Delta, Major League Baseball, Pepsi, all those have been pushing various progressive agendas. Americans don't like it. There's a poll recently came out, 65% of Americans think they ought to stick to selling Pepsi and stay out of the social change business.
Well, those are presumably shareholders, not stakeholders. And this is part of that progressive agenda. You called it ESG, environment, social justice, governance. It's about, giving people who aren't actually part of the company, the benefits of the company, and not so much people who are.
Next time we go to an investor conference, let's ask them to define what a stakeholder is. You get into that and it just ends up the blurriest definition.
It can be anybody
imaginable.
You want it to be, I think. Yeah, exactly right. Hey, Bill, I was talking with Gordon in the previous segment about a problem with respect to China that has truly global implications, namely food shortages and what China is doing to corner the market, as it is wont to do, on rare earth minerals and lots of other things, on food as well. And it's taken huge positions on grains and corn and other commodities that, would be in very short supply if it turns out it's not just China that is short of food, but others of us as well. You have called to my attention an article about what may be a driving factor in that food shortage in China, and one that has repercussions, again, far beyond China's borders, particularly in Asia, namely the shortage of water and what the Chinese are doing to deprive people downstream on rivers that flow through China of water they desperately need as well. What can you tell us about that?
Well, let's give some credit to Hal Brands at AEI, who was writing a book about this issue. It's called The Danger Zone. He wrote it with Michael Beckley. And we think of, there's a tendency, if you're not too close to it, to think of China as inevitable. Massive land area, huge population, 1.4 billion. And they've successfully implemented some capitalist reforms. They played the global trade system effectively. And The fact is they're not inevitable. China is now the world's largest energy importer. It buys almost 3/4 of its oil abroad. And this is the same time Donald Trump was making the United States a net importer. And it has 20% of the world's population, but only 7% of its fresh water. And the food shortage is in part due to the water problem. And, you know, we also need to step back and see how polluted China really is. Its rivers and lakes are incredibly toxic. And there's estimates that some 80, 90% of its groundwater and half its river water is too dirty to drink. And so they're now beginning to adjust. And of course, in typical Chinese imperial fashion, they're deciding, well, if they build some dams on the Mekong River, they can preserve water for the Chinese. But what that does is it beggars the countries downstream, Thailand, Laos, you know, really devastating effects in the rest of Central Asia. And they're also going to dam some rivers that lead into India and Bangladesh. And so China, in solving parochially its water problem, is creating just more and more enemies around its border. I mean, they already don't like China very much for a lot of other reasons. But when you start damming the river upstream, it's sort of like the old West. You know, those are fighting. That's a fighting word for fighting, whatever my term is here. Let's get out our six guns and go after them.
Well, and Tibet is a place where this is being particularly egregiously felt, because the headwaters of whatever it is, 7 or 9 of the world's most important rivers, I believe, come out of that watershed, and the Chinese are busily despoiling that land with, you know, dams and other water projects to divert the water to China from
Tibet's sort of the epicenter, the mother of all rivers. Phenomena.
No, you're exactly right. And they've treated the Tibetans very badly for a long time, but this is taking it to a whole new level, I'm afraid. Bill, lastly, let me just ask you about the genocide games, if I could. We have been told for some time now that they're inevitable as well, that the Chinese are going to have their way, that the United States government may or may not even diplomatically boycott them. But certainly there's not going to be any chance that the athletes will forego the opportunity to compete in Beijing. And in the process, you know, as Gordon was noting, legitimate arguably the most horrific regime on the planet in the midst of its genocide, no less. Yet, there do seem to be developments, including this burgeoning outbreak of COVID and perhaps other diseases, hemorrhagic fever among them, that are now, as Gordon has pointed out, not simply elsewhere in China. They're in close proximity to Beijing and will almost certainly be evident, at least some of these problems of the pandemic, in close proximity to the Olympic Games. My personal view is that the athletes are at risk if they go. I think from perhaps other ploys that the Chinese may pull, like using quarantine to diminish their preparedness to compete. But apart from that, just simply the likelihood that they will be exposed to one or the other of these possibly life-threatening diseases would seem to be a pretty compelling reason for them not to participate, let alone become part of perhaps China's next athlete driven super spreader event. Your thoughts?
Well, if these Olympics, which are just about a month away, if these Olympics were held in any other country with this list of problems that you just cited, there'd be an international cry to move it or postpone it and to dodge this impending catastrophe. But it's not just another country, it's China. And China has so many deep relationships with U.S. People involved in that world, the NBA, you know, Disney, Nike. I mean, a lot of the sports world, athletic world, the networks, they're all making a fortune from their business with China. And the Chinese are very aggressive about saying, if you go against us on anything, we're going to come back at you and hurt your profitability, or maybe toss you out of the country or shut you down. And so this is an interesting test of the international community. And so far, The international community is flunking it. And I've got a dissident Chen Guangxing coming on my show later on this week, and hopefully we'll get the show out this weekend or Monday. You know, he
with our friend Reggie Littlejohn as well, as I understand it.
With the wonderful Reggie Littlejohn, who's been fighting this fight forever. And we'll be talking about this. And of course, Chen has been inside Chinese prisons. He knows firsthand what this is like to be a Chinese dissident or to be caught in the web of being opposed to the Chinese Communist Party. And he's got a long list of abuses, and it will be interesting to hear from him. It'll be fascinating TV because Chen is blind and so doesn't speak much English, and so we'll have an interpreter. But his voice, he was so compelling.
So important.
You almost felt like you almost understood him in Chinese. Yeah.
Well, good. We all should understand him because he's speaking an international language, that's for sure, that of human rights and freedom and how it is being imperiled by the Chinese Communist Party. Bill, I salute you for that focus of your program. It is a terrific one. Please follow Bill Walton's television program and other works, and of course, follow him here. And Bill, we look forward to visiting with you again next week. Same time, same station. Until then, stay well, my friend. Thank you for joining us. Sam Faddis is up next, completing our trifecta for Monday, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by a third of our regulars here on Mondays at Secure Freedom Radio. I couldn't be more pleased to say. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. You know him as a former undercover Central Intelligence Agency operative, among other things. These days, he is the driving force behind a terrific online resource, andmagazine.com. And there are several things that he's written about in recent days there that I wanted to make sure we covered with you all, in particular because Sam, as is often the case, is keeping his eye on the ball, on things that most of us are overlooking or ignoring or simply missing the significance of. And one of them is, what is emerging now in the aftermath of Joe Biden's ignominious defeat in Afghanistan, and in particular, the surrender of large sums of money and enormous amounts of advanced weaponry to one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations on the planet, the Taliban? It's good to have you back with us, Sam. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Great to be here, as always. Thank you.
So just walk us through a little bit about the possible order of battle of the Taliban now and what they may have in mind doing with their military capabilities and terrorist ideology.
Well, I mean, as is always, I feel like we end up starting at the same point. We have an administration in Washington that sort of just wants to peddle nonsense and propaganda and lies and tell you that, you know, it's not really a big deal. The Taliban took over in Afghanistan, but they're kinder and gentler, and there's some sort of Taliban 2.0. And none of that, of course, is true. It appears to me that they're a little more media savvy and so a little more adept at manipulating the media. But in terms of what they're doing, they are transforming Afghanistan. I mean, they have declared an Islamic emirate, and they are transforming Afghanistan into a brutal, barbaric 6th century wasteland. They are gradually, you know, they are step by step imposing all the same rules that they imposed back in the 90s. You know, women can't leave home now without a male escort. Schools are closed. Women are thrown out of work. Barbers are being harassed for daring to trim a beard, all of this kind of stuff. But they are also doing some things that are a lot more muscular, immediately threatening. They are actively forming what is either, according to, depending on who you listen to, either 100,000 or 150,000 man military, formal military, organized units, of course, using all of the equipment that Joe left for them and then has declined to destroy since. They are specifically forming a component of that military, which is all suicide bombers. Continuing to glorify that cult of death, and already really embroiled in some pretty serious border disputes with Tajikistan and Pakistan and so forth. So I mean, we're where are they headed with this? They're headed up for a continuation of jihad beyond their borders, in my estimation.
The suicide bomber component is particularly arresting, shall we say, in the sense that that's a problem if you just have one suicide bomber or even perhaps a small number of them engaged in suicide missions like 9/11. But the idea that you might have a cohort of them organized and trained and supported by a government raises this to a whole new level, especially, Sam, if, as you know very well from your time in some of the badlands of Pakistan, they are able to be dispatched worldwide to advance the agenda of global jihad and the ultimate realization of Sharia's agenda of a worldwide caliphate. No?
Yeah, and this is exactly what their intention is, right? People often either aren't aware of exactly what the worldview is, or they just don't want to face it. But there is no intention here to seek coexistence. They're not simply looking for some sort of Taliban homeland. They are dedicated to violent jihad and the spread worldwide and the establishment of a worldwide caliphate. And when it comes to suicide bombers, these folks, as many of the other terrorist groups, Islamic terrorist groups, do glorify. This is really a cult of death. It is not simply a matter that their fighters are willing to die in pursuit of a cause. This is how you enter paradise, right? Quite literally. This is not an abstract concept for them. You want to die. As long as you die in, you know, performing jihad, suicide in and of itself is regarded as a sin. But killing yourself as you are killing infidels and fighting the fight is the most glorious way to die that there is. This is perfection. This is paradise.
To say nothing of the 72 virgins, right?
People talk about that, and I have dealt a lot with these folks, and I've even interviewed suicide bombers who were not obviously successful, or I wouldn't have been interviewing them. But they are recruited believing that this is an immediate physical reality. You will die, and then the next moment you will be in paradise, including enjoying the company of the 72 virgins for the rest of time. And they're also, you know, much more immediate earthly things they do here. They go around compensate the families of suicide bombers. They give them land, recognition, and money. A lot of these guys are young guys. You go to a family that can barely feed the kids that they have and offer to turn them into rock stars and hand them a lot of cash if one of their sons agrees to blow himself up, and you got a lot of recruits. So yes, now they're forming an organized a group. It's unclear how many, but we're talking many, many hundreds of these folks. Some of them apparently have already been dispatched to the border with Tajikistan because there's an ongoing dispute there. It's only a matter of time until you start seeing them detonating themselves in Pakistan, because the Pakistanis they think they control the Taliban, and they are finding out very quickly that they don't.
And that's an interesting data point. Again, you served for some time during the course of the Afghan campaign in Pakistan. The difference between the Sharia adherents of the Pakistani government and that pursued by the Taliban would seem to most outward observers to be minimal. And yet there is now a growing indication that the Taliban is going to pursue jihad against its fellow jihadists and erstwhile enablers in the Pakistani government. No, what is the ideological or theological purpose or justification for this, Sam? Or is it just a question of power and the aspiration on the part of the Taliban to get their hands on those nuclear weapons, the Pakistani army?
Well, I mean, I think the portion of this is that, you know, sort of more earthly or worldly things begin to intrude. This is why we end up with jihadist groups whose ideologies are, to any outside observer, essentially indistinguishable, and yet they will fight each other and kill each other and blow each other up, and each one of them claiming to be more holy than the other. The prize of what is probably at least 200 nuclear warheads sitting in Pakistan is, of course, enormous. And as you've suggested many times when we've been talking, absolutely true that this ideology, this jihadism, has burrowed its way into the Pakistani establishment long, long ago. I mean, you got a lot of people in very important positions, including probably some of those who are charged with guarding nuclear weapons, who believe that in this jihadist cause. They are not secular in any sense. So, I mean, the Pakistanis and the Taliban are already having a major fight over the Durand Line, right, which divides Pakistan from Afghanistan and was drawn by the Brits way back when. The Taliban has always said they pay no attention to it. It basically divides the Pashtun areas in half. Most of the Taliban are Pashtun. The Pakistanis are now frantically fencing, building a border wall between them and the Taliban, trying to keep them out. And the Taliban is regularly going out and destroying the fencing, and also now overtly threatening Pakistan if they continue to do this. That is a clear demonstration. They are very serious when they say they do not recognize the existence of that border. So there are big chunks of Pakistan that they are laying claim to as part of this Pashtun homeland. So,
in which the Taliban has been operating for some time. And this is part of what was our problem in Afghanistan, and why your work for the Central Intelligence Agency was so vital, Sam, was keeping eyes on what was going on in the sort of support infrastructure across that border in Pakistan with the active, you know, connivance of the government there, and very much to the detriment of American military personnel and interests across the border in Afghanistan. Sam, let me turn to another topic quickly with you before we run out of time. You, of course, have been very active with our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and otherwise on the Chinese front. And I'm interested in your thoughts about this question of the genocide games. We have launched, as you know, a new campaign intended to try to press the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee to protect our athletes, save our Olympic athletes, as we call it, from what seems to be a very high probability that they will be subjected in Beijing to, at a minimum, quarantine, which can be very hard for their training regimen, maybe even essentially rendering them incapable of competing effectively in the games, but also possibly exposing themselves to some very dangerous diseases, possibly some new strain of COVID, or even hemorrhagic fever. What are your recommendations, Sam, about the advisability of sending our Olympic athletes into Beijing next month under these circumstances?
Well, of course, I think it's grotesque that we're sending anybody that we ever intended to send anybody anyway. I mean, when we get to the fact that we're talking about a brutal communist regime that has concentration camps, executes dissidents, and engages in forced organ harvesting, it seems to me that ought to be enough to say we're not going to play. But on this, just on this disease front that you've identified here, it's kind of insane that we're going to send our people. We're still, we clearly 2 years into this are not making a dent in controlling the spread of COVID. And now we're going to send all these people to an event at the epicenter of the pandemic and then bring them all back here. And we're going to encourage people from all over the globe to do the same. That's madness. That's contrary to every principle of controlling a pandemic.
And we're doing it under the, I guess, pretext that the Chinese government is assuring these athletes that they will be kept safe. But when they are locking down cities of 13 million people, it seems pretty clear they're not able to keep anybody safe, let alone people who they have a powerful interest in infecting, arguably, based on what we saw them do with the military games in 2019, I believe. And certainly what they have an interest in doing to reduce their competition for the gold at the Olympics. I mean, this seems to be so removed from, well, just plain common sense, Sam, let alone prudent public health policy or national security policy, for that matter. It's hard to countenance what on earth the government of the United States, the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, or for that matter, even the athletes themselves are thinking on these scores.
Yeah, well, I think basically we have a government that is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the communist Chinese and terrified of the prospect of offending them or standing up to them. As you say, when you tell me that you're going to control the spread of this disease, you being the Chinese Communist Party, but 2 years into this thing, you're having to lock down cities of 15 million people in some terrified bid to contain something that manifestly have demonstrated you can't contain. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to pay any attention to any of your assurance. I don't care what you say to me. You have demonstrated in the real world that you have no idea what you're doing. This is giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're even trying, right? There is the other dimension that you've alluded to, that they've deliberately spread these things or that kind of evil intent. But even giving them the benefit of the doubt, they have at a minimum demonstrated they have absolutely no idea how to stop the spread of this disease.
Sam, last and very quickly, if I can, we are now hearing from the United States government, with the qualities you've just described, that actually our relationship with China in the shared endeavor to control climate change trumps whatever unease we have about the threat posed by the Chinese to us. As a seasoned as well as highly accomplished national security professional, what do you say in response to that?
Well, it'd be laughable if it wasn't so terrifying, right? We're now going to say that our partnership with a totalitarian communist regime trumps everything else. This whole business about climate change, by the way, is the next front in this, right? Having established the principle that your constitutional rights don't matter if we declare a health emergency, we now have created an environment in which anything that gets labeled a health emergency will justify the suspension of your constitutional rights. And the next thing up is climate change, at which point you will discover that the government will tell you what kind of car you can buy, if you can drive it, what kind of fuel you can burn, where you can set your thermostat and everything else on Earth if we concede these points.
And the Chinese will have helpfully contributed the social credit system to facilitate that kind of control at the great expense, of course, of what's left of our freedoms. Sam Fattis, your clarity on all of these points is so appreciated, as is your tracking at endmagazine.com, these tremendously important issues that are not getting the kind of attention that they require. I salute you for doing that, my friend. Your continuing service to our country, as well as that you've rendered in the past, is so appreciated, as is your time with us here each week. We'll look forward to doing it again next week. Till then, stay well, my friend. Until then, I hope the rest of you will plan on being back with us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Breitbart.com reported this week that the Chinese communists claim to have outperformed Hollywood at the global box office. True or not, we mustn't ignore the importance our mortal enemies assign to winning the culture war. That's because, as the late, great Andrew Breitbart famously observed, quote, politics is downstream from culture, unquote. The CCP's bid for dominating the world politically required that it buy up, control, and otherwise eviscerate the U.S. movie industry, and it has done so. Beijing's boast about crushing Hollywood with a propaganda film about China defeating American Marines in Korea is a milestone in the countdown to coming kinetic conflicts. When that happens, possibly as soon as this March, where will we find our Frank Capra, the iconic filmmaker who rallied our country to victory in World War II? Sadly, his counterpart now works for the Chinese Communist Party. This is Frank Gaffney.